Good to see you all here. It's good to be here. It works well to introduce myself because it can actually, that sets the context for what I'm about to talk about. So I'm a longtime public health nurse working nearby here in Oakland. I left the health department about 6 years ago and started teaching. And when I started teaching, I was thinking more in terms of, rather than clinical preventive services, bringing into the clinical groups community preventive services. But I found that there was a couple of barriers to that. One, we don't have the students long enough to really get into community approaches. Two, this was a general baccalaureate programs where I was teaching, and so there was students had not particular interest in community health, but it was part of their curriculum. And three, I found that the students actually lacked some of the more basic knowledge of clinical preventive services, and I'll kind of get into that. So it led me to looking for new modalities to teach in a short time frame the kind of things that were what we considered basic community health. So anyway, this is the group of students that I was working with myself at the top. And the group of students that I was working with last fall. There's since been new groups of students, but no relationships to reflect on financial. I wish I could say that there was financial relationships, but unfortunately not. Anyway, that's another story. Okay, so hopefully, it sounds like there's some nursing instructors in the audience. Hopefully this may be of useful information to looking at different ways of bringing some of this kind of education into the nursing curriculum. Just recently, CDC, the MMWR, reported on the use of clinical preventive services. This is just last June. As kind of a forerunner to what's happening nationwide, that there is much more emphasis in the plan, the expanded healthcare plan that's going to be rolling out, much more emphasis on clinical preventive services and basing the those particular services on the recommendations of the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force. So I thought this was an appropriate they build this report as a baseline as far as usage, which really wasn't very good if you look at the full report, and looking at doing this repeatedly once we start implementing our healthcare reform. And so when it comes to clinical preventive services, there's guidance on how to use them, what populations they're for, how to interpret them from several sources. And I list some here, primarily the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. But of course, when it comes to immunization, we have the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. And then there's many other panels, expert panels, that make recommendations in their particular fields with regards to asthma, with regards to other kinds of services, prevention of hypertension, sexually transmitted diseases, and so forth. And diabetes and whatnot. So all of these are important sources to refer to, especially in terms of nursing education. We're trying to teach our students that what we're doing is evidence-based, and so they need to see, well, where is the basis for these recommendations? And in the last couple of years, it's caught the media's attention when the recommendations have been contrary to what had been previous practice. So everyone's fairly familiar with some of that controversial decisions around the age for mammograms for men, the PSA testing and that sort of thing. It's hit the news, so it's in the consciousness of the students. They're hearing this too, so we get to really use that as a basis for teaching. How do we decide? What do we do with the information? And where do we go with that? So the most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force, which is a primary source of guidance, but not the only. and I'll kind of get to that a little later. Also within our curriculum, as I mentioned, we're looking at the wellness illness curriculum, although much of their experience, which I was finding when I would get them in community health, was in their fourth semester, but they had spent most of their time in the hospital. So I was actually quite surprised that they knew so little about the more basic preventive approaches. They were really sharp students and knew the acute and the end stage treatment, but the earlier was a little beyond them. So that was kind of a revelation to me. So that's where I proceeded. So I started looking for opportunities. And one of the interesting places I was placed with students was in San Francisco Head Start. So that was an interesting setting. I actually didn't quite know what to do with it in the beginning. But it learned very quickly what to do with Head Start as a wonderful place to teach community health nursing. I'll point out this is a map, San Francisco Head Start. This is a map of our fair city, San Francisco. And there's Head Starts all over the city in neighborhoods where vulnerable populations, low-income families live. The population, though, is preschool, if you're not familiar with the federal program. So that was an early childhood intervention. So the screening and the kind of activities were different than would be for older adults. So I wasn't content with just having them get that experience with small children and actively sought out a relationship with Chinatown Community Development Center, which this map shows the greater Chinatown area and the housing that it's a wonderful organization that's done a wonderful job of developing housing for low-income seniors throughout the northeast part of the city. And so they were more than happy to have us work with them and provide health screenings for the seniors and well-received we called them health fairs. With the students, I call it screening and clinical preventive services. But to the residents, they were health fairs. So well received. Additionally, which to a smaller extent couldn't bring as many students in, working with the Alameda County Public Health Department and Project New Start, the tattoo removal program, which presented this morning in another session, the great work that's being done there. And the presenters are here in the room, I'm glad to say. But that program, working with yet another age group, one that's largely neglected when it comes to prevention, and that's the young adults. Older adolescents and young adults, but yet very vulnerable population. These are young people leaving lifestyles, gangs and whatnot, that are getting their tattoos removed and are largely uninsured and in transition. So when we started working with that program, I realized that they're in the program getting a lot of social support, psychosocial support, but here they were in the waiting rooms, and they're returning every other month, but the physical approach was assessment was not being done. So I thought, this is a wonderful opportunity for the students not only to see the actual treatment and to assist, because it's a volunteer clinic, but actually use the opportunity to talk to the young people with regards to their primary health care, preventive issues, and even bring immunizations, which we are still doing. So we've been doing this for some years now. So these are our three opportunities, looking at age groups, different age groups across the lifespan. I almost wasn't going to submit this as an abstract, but when I saw that the theme was health promotion through the lifespan, I said, well, if not this year, what year will it be? So we're doing that. So here's a cover of the Guide to Clinical Preventive Services, and these are some of the things that we're able to offer, not all the same in all three settings, but appropriately to the age population. Oral health screening, I have a little more to say about that. Blood pressure, glucose, cholesterol, weight, BMI, blood lead testing, especially for the small children. vision and hearing immunization, and with especially with the adolescents developing screening for depression, intimate partner violence, use of tobacco, drug, and alcohol. So with regards to oral health, I have to admit, as a public health nurse, I didn't have a large focus on oral health. Certainly, we had dental clinics and accessed it, but honestly, it wasn't a real focus. Well, I'm not alone. In the year 2000, the landmark report from the U.S. Surgeon General with regards to oral health in America really was a wake-up call to a lot of us working in public health that the mouth is part of our health, and it really isn't just for dentists. That call, although responded to in many ways, sadly, in 2011, just last year, two major follow-up reports came out, and we haven't actually done that well in broadening out oral health assessment to other non-dental providers. So schools of medicine, pediatricians, nurses, public health nurses, and one of the comments, probably too small to read, was that there was a real mixed bag when it came to assessing schools of nursing and incorporating oral health, dental health in the education. So I really took that quite seriously from the time when I was working with Head Start and actually was the health manager at Head Start. That was a real eye-opener for me to realize what we're really talking about here as a huge need in our low-income families with the cavities at early childhood age. Horrible situation. So I ended up partnering with the local dental society and a local clinic that really had a particular passion for pediatric dentistry, and they were more than happy to provide training to the nurses and perfect practicum with the classrooms at Head Start. So you can see, I don't have a lot of content, but I've got nice pictures of students doing doing their work. It was an eye-opener for them, too. All of them are, I think, really going to go into their practice in nursing, wherever they're at, with a much greater appreciation for oral health and being able to really do a good assessment of oral health. And actually, we're doing varnishing and using dental guidelines, not just looking at the mouth and saying, oh, look, but really being able to identify teeth and score the seriousness of their condition and make recommendation. Blood pressure, of course, we have lots of guidelines around blood pressure, and that is just we're doing that with the small children. It's required by federal and recommendations, but by federal requirements at Head Start and certainly through the lifespan. But the interpretation for children is much different, and the students have to learn that, the interpretation of those results. Glucose, a very easy intervention, but again, it's the interpretation that I really tried to emphasize with the students. And whether it be fasting or non-fasting, they have to learn how to make the proper interpretation. And they get confidence with some of their skills in working with patients at all age groups. Blood lead level, also, that was in partnership with the city of San Francisco. We were able to pay for the blood lead level screening when oftentimes the pediatricians aren't doing it, thinking that it's not so much of a risk in California, and yet our low-income children are at greater risk. And the same thing goes with hemoglobin, but we weren't doing hemoglobin testing at this point. One of the things I wanted to point out was the importance of teaching them proper techniques. I was kind of appalled that I've heard that nurses are using these self-administered blood lancets. They're designed for individuals to use for themselves, not in a clinical setting. And yet I've read reports from CDC that there's been outbreaks of hepatitis transmitted by screening of and they change the lancet, but they don't change the instrument. And of course, it's contaminated. It never occurred to me that someone would be so silly to use something that's designed for an individual on a group setting. So I've really taken the time to not make assumptions and really teach the students that, no, we never use this. We will never use this in a clinical setting where we're going from patient to patient, but we have to use individual lancets that are discarded afterwards in their entirety. So that's my infection control part. Cholesterol was something that we were able to add on later. We got a small grant. We were able to, I'm not sure what you're using, but we used the Cholestech little machine, works really well. And we're using that. Again, I'm showing pictures of the guidance that we're getting on interpretation that I can have the students refer to and learn from. Immunizations, of course, the standard guidelines at all age groups. I teach them how to use the schedules and how to properly screen for whatever age group and administer properly. Vision acuity, another aspect that many of the nurses really didn't get training on, but because of working with small children, we were able to actually provide certification training for them, because when it comes to the small children, the requirements of the EPSDT program, we call it CHDP in California, there are specific requirements on training for that. And in California, we have the Prevent Blindness. It's a nationwide organization, but in California, it's called Northern California, and they're able to do that. So through that work, we're able to offer it to the seniors. With the seniors, it's a little different. Children, we're looking for not only myopia, but even more importantly, amblyopia, when there's a difference in focal length with undetected, treatable, otherwise leading to what's commonly called lazy eye. We really take that quite seriously with the small children. But with adults, it's a different issue. Same techniques, but we're really able to see, is their prescription still working? Are they not seeing as well as they could be? And we're able to refer them back to an optometrist. I also send the students out to look for resources. They spend days out in the streets talking to optometrists and dentists to find out if they take Medi-Cal, Medicare, Medicaid, and at what age will they start seeing children. Many dentists aren't taking children. Audiometric screening, also something that is not generally offered to nursing students, but because of the certification requirements for small children, they're able to learn this. We were able to purchase a couple of machines after I was borrowing them from Head Start. Now we have our own, and they're able to, the seniors love it. They love being tested, but it's really actually quite tricky with the seniors. What we're finding, of course, it's high level of hearing problems in the seniors, but what we're really kind of shocked to find is how many are seriously not hearing, even in the range of not being able to follow conversation. There's a lot of problems around our seniors in accessing hearing aids. Even when they have them, sometimes they're not well fitted, they're not working. So we've worked really closely with this organization here locally, the Hearing and Speech Center, because they've been very good at outreach and working with seniors and helping them get onto proper payment through Medicare. And the students learn how to do a proper audiometry screening. So their experience is that they're assigned to Head Start sites. They're then scheduled to do the screenings at the senior resident sites. But when it comes to the tattoo removal clinic, what I've been doing is working with just a small group of students for the entire semester. They come once a month, and these are students who are very interested in community health, and they're able to really get some more in-depth work with the population. And they've been very instrumental at helping us to develop a two-page form that we're using with the adolescents. That's a very comprehensive screening it's still in development. We also have access to the electronic preventive service selector. It's a nice application. that you put in the age and the sex, and you're able to really get what are the recommended screening tools that can be used with this particular age group. So this has been very successful over the last few years, to the point where right now we're doing a curriculum, a major curriculum change, and we're going to be taking a lot of what we've developed for the community health at the fourth semester and moving it to the very beginning, which the students would say, we should have got this in the beginning, and so now they're going to get it in the beginning. And I think it's quite appropriate for them to be exposed to basic screening and basic wellness information and looking at the range and variance in an ambulatory care setting before they actually get into the hospital. So I'm very excited about our new curriculum. It's a major change. We're going from five semesters to four, so I don't know how that's going to work, but we will be moving a lot of this kind of activity, not just for a few students in certain clinical groups, but for the entire cohort of students. So that's in development and maybe actually come up in the fall. So I want to acknowledge the group. This was our team from last fall, and they've gone on, graduated in most cases. She's still in school, but the others have graduated and are working in various parts of the state. We were able to get a couple of small grants. The California Endowment, through Dr. Chen, who's one of the doctors at the Tattoo Removal Clinic, was on the board of directors of the Cal Endowment, and they have a discretionary fund. So although we didn't really fit in any of the California Endowment's larger grants, we were able to get some support through Dr. Chen. School of Public Health gave us a small amount. I'm currently a student in this program, back to school. And so I got a small grant. And then a larger grant, about the same size as what we got from Dr. Chen, was from the School of Nursing. There were some funds left over at the end of the year, and there was a call for some grant application, and I was appreciative of getting some additional funds to buy supplies and equipment. We have better supplies now than we ever have, and I certainly appreciate that. But thank you, and that's the end of that.